regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to the latest installment of the Tech Roundup podcast, which is part of the Regulatory Transparency Project's ongoing fourth branch podcast series. Our Tech Roundup podcast features leading policy experts debating the major legal issues surrounding various emerging technology industries. My name is Adam Thier, and I'm a senior research fellow with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and I'll be your host and a participant in today's discussion. On today's show, we will be specifically discussing important breaking news in the world of emerging technology policy. Specifically, last week, the Trump administration made two major announcements related to the governance of artificial intelligence and autonomous vehicles. To examine the ramifications of these announcements, I am pleased to be joined here on today's program by my friend Caleb Watney, who is a resident fellow in technology and innovation policy at the R Street Institute, which is a nonprofit public policy research organization here in D.C. Moreover, Caleb and I used to work together at the Mercatus Center, and as we will discuss in just a moment, he and I have written together about these issues together in the past. So, Caleb, welcome, and thanks for joining me on today's show.
Thanks for having me on.
So I usually try to play the role of a semi-objective moderator whenever I host this podcast, but today I'm going to jump in and be an equal participant with Caleb in discussing our views on these recent developments and what they mean for the future of AI and autonomous vehicle systems. In fact, this is something I spilled out about 3,000 words on last week in an essay on Trump's AI framework and the future of emerging tech governance, which is a piece that's available on Medium if you care to take a look. But let me first ask Caleb to help me with some background and ask what's been happening on the autonomous vehicle front, and then we will broaden it back out to discuss AI policy more generally. And we'll also have a brief discussion about how so-called soft law appears to be expanding in this space, for better or for worse. So, Caleb, driverless cars have been a hot policy topic now for many years here in the U.S., not only at the federal level, but also in the states. And I want to ask you to take us back maybe 4 or 5 years or so and tell us how AV policy got started both in Congress and then at the Department of Transportation with its AV guidance documents and then where we stand today.
Sure. No, happy to give a brief overview there. So I think the first kind of questions pop up here. I think, you know, in the early 2000s, you had funding for, you know, very speculative at that time, you know, driverless car experiments. They did a big test in the desert, you know, and they tried to, the government was trying to jumpstart the industry at that point. And then kind of it fell out of the news for a while. In early, you know, 2010, you saw Google was starting to put a lot more money behind trying to revive their driverless car efforts. They thought that the technology had matured. And so it was really when you started seeing companies explore the idea of deploying this technology on public streets that, of course, regulators and legislative bodies started getting interested. And so I think there's two broad movements you've seen. The first is on the regulatory side, you have the Department of Transportation, first under the Obama administration and now under the Trump administration, be putting out this successive guidance documents branded, you know, autonomous vehicle guidance 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, and now just 4.0 that recently came out. The first iteration was perhaps the biggest departure from the rest of the series. It was branded as kind of being exploratory, like we don't really know how we want to approach this issue. Let's just throw out a bunch of possible governance frameworks and kind of we'll get feedback from the public on those. That was one of the first projects I worked on with you, and we pushed back pretty hard on the idea of pre-market approval, saying, hey, you know, the Federal Aviation Administration has to pre-approve every single new airplane model before it comes out. And, you know, it's a small detail that takes, you know, 7 to 8 years and hundreds of millions of dollars to approve, but, you know, small detail. Let's see how that fits to cars. We pushed back on that pretty strongly, as did a lot of the public, and it was good to see that in the later documents that came out, they kind of withdrew from that. It's become a lot more about How do we modernize the existing approach? We have this huge body of federal motor vehicle safety standards that govern the existence or the current deployment of cars. You have to meet predefined standards. Manufacturers will tell NHTSA, certify that, yes, we do meet these standards. And then NHTSA later goes on and actually tests the cars to make sure that they're following with these standards.
And NHTSA is the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration,
yes, yes.
Which effectively regulates federal motor vehicle safety standards at the federal level.
Yep. So on the one hand, you've seen this sort of regulatory, evolution as they've been trying to figure out how do we modify our existing framework. And then you've seen another approach, or it's sort of in the same line, but perhaps a different focus coming from Congress. Over the last couple of years, there was a flurry of legislative efforts to try to pass a federal framework for driverless cars, which ultimately did not pass. There was a lot of flurry about it over the past couple of years. But some of the biggest aspects of that was federal preemption, saying that if NHTSA has guidelines that conflict with states in terms of how they're trying to regulate specifically the safety and manufacturing standards, then NHTSA's rules would preempt those. Additionally, there were questions about sort of in this in-between process, how do we handle federal motor vehicle safety standard exemptions? Sort of before we have the new standards, how do we handle it in this in-between period? I think there's still interest in Congress, but ultimately the efforts did not pass.
So a couple things about what you said there. First of all, when we were filing to NHTSA about their 1.0 guidance, this was 2016. And like you said, there had some concerning elements in it about pre-market approval. There was also some language about regulating software code updates in vehicles, which we pushed back very aggressively. And we sort of got our way. I don't want to say it was all due to us that we won, but when 2.0 guidance came out a year or so later, that was all stripped out. And the document became a little bit more amorphous about what it was that DOT was seeking to do. This was true still even more further when we got to 3.0. And by this time, we should point out to the listener, the document had become sort of a glossy PowerPoint that didn't even have a date on the front of it. And now we have 4.0, which came out just last week, which is a little bit more formal and it's still a nice glossy document, but it's not really official agency rulemaking. It's still in the guidance world. So this very much reflects the fact that for AV policy circa 2020, we're still stuck in a world, for better or worse, of what some call soft law for emerging tech, where we have agency guidances, workshops, informal kind of statements, even social media posts and notices that, for better or for worse, are sort of the rules of the road, if you will, for driverless cars. And as you just said, we don't see traction in Congress for driverless car legislation, but the states are still a player. So maybe you can briefly mention some of what's been happening in the states, again, for better or for worse, on this front in the meantime.
Yeah, so in the absence of federal preemption or a federal framework, you've seen a pretty strong divergence between different states in terms of their approach of allowing driverless cars to be tested. Arizona has probably been the most aggressive in trying to say, hey, come test here in Arizona. We want to make ourselves a sandbox for the testing of this new exciting technology. And so you have seen a lot of the initial testing has been happening, especially in the Arizona suburbs or in the Phoenix suburbs. I think part of that is the, clear regulatory, we're going to make sure that you have clear legal certainty that you can deploy under XYZ. But also the weather, I think, helps there. It's easier to test in areas where there's a little rain or snow and ice. Areas around Phoenix have pretty good infrastructure, clear wide roads with stop signs that are all, clear and not a lot of potholes. So I think it's sort of a combination of these regulatory factors with a good sort of physical environment for early testing. You've also seen more recently, attempts to test in more complex urban environments, sort of saying, we know that not every city is like Phoenix. You have places like Pittsburgh that for a while Uber was testing there very aggressively and trying to also tease out what are some of like the local traffic environments that might change. You know, you have a Pittsburgh left that doesn't apply in other cities. And so how do you, you know, code that in and get the car to learn? I know that right now Detroit is seeing a lot of testing because they explicitly want to try testing in these more difficult, you know, weather environments. California has also been a big hub. I think they're less so because the rules are good, but because it's just so close to home for a lot of these tech companies, right. It's easier to test.
You mentioned California. It's interesting because there's a bit of a patchwork developing for driverless cars, but right now, in some ways, it's got some good elements to it, but there's also some bad. California initially came out of the gates and told Google and others, like, you need to have a steering wheel and pedals in all your driverless cars. And they kind of pushed back and said, well, the whole point of driverless cars is to take humans out of the element. So we saw some early meddling by California. There was also meddling by San Francisco with Uber's driverless car fleet, which led to the Arizona thing where the governor basically literally tweeted out, like inviting Uber, like, hey, we heard you're getting some trouble up there in California. Send your fleet down here. Another example of what we often refer to as innovation arbitrage in our area, where innovators often move to wherever they're treated most hospitably. So that's some interesting developments in the state. So just high level, let's just talk, like, where do we see things going after 2020 and after guidance 4.0? The latest guidance, we should mention, is pretty thick, but really is just sort of almost a resuscitation of, like, here are our powers. Here's kind of what we've done or what we could do, but not really any statement of what they're going to do.
Yep. It's. I think I saw Mark Scribner from CEI describe it as a guidance document for future guidance documents.
And Ian Adams described it to us once as a nothing burger, right?
Yeah.
There's just not much here. And I see that. But what's interesting that I think, reading between the lines and specifically reading to the appendix, which nerds like us do, we find a lot of discussion about interagency coordination. Mm-hmm. And the appendix to this guidance document, the 4.0 document, lists out all of the different agencies and sub-agencies and agency people working on this issue, not just DOT and NHTSA, but well beyond that in other agencies. And in many different ways, many different components. Safety is obviously the leading one, but privacy and security issues, cybersecurity and so on. So there's a lot of different chefs in the kitchen trying to bake this pie. But the question is, you know, is there a method to this madness? Are we going to get anything? I still believe, and I still make random side bets with people, like, we're never going to get any driverless car legislation. That Congress is just so dysfunctional, it won't happen. And for like 5 or 6 years, I've been betting people on this. Like, no, this is the year it gets done. And you and I used to joke about this. But it doesn't get done. And yet we're moving forward, right? Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, I think if there is a good thing about the appendix, you know, that you mentioned, it does show that there's a lot of conversations happening, which I think is good. It's sort of building the sort of soft policy infrastructure that doesn't look like formal committees, but is kind of, you know, the people in the different agencies know each other. And, you know, suddenly when there is a cybersecurity problem for autonomous vehicles, there's some blow up. The people at the different regulatory agencies know each other. Hopefully they can collaborate, make sure that their approaches are at least not differing in terms of how they're going to, you know, enforce various aspects of it. So that's good. I think one reason we've seen less, I guess, urgency to pass a comprehensive federal framework is there has been maybe slower than expected technical rollout. I think if it was the case that, you know, driverless cars were ready to have full, you know, nationwide deployment tomorrow, there would be, you know, a lot more urgency to actually get a new framework out. But I think especially as we're thinking about this in the broad scope, we've seen policy has not been the major factor slowing down driverless car deployment. I think if you would have asked me, you know, 5-6 years ago, whether it will be technical slowdowns or policy slowdowns that are actually, you know, the final driver before driverless cars can go on the road, I would have expected policy to almost certainly be the final roadblock. So this has been an unexpectedly positive. Of course, you know, not everything in the approach is perfect, and there's lots of ways it could be better. But in the broad scope of things, the approach has been surprisingly permissive. And I think there's been good collaboration between industry actors and regulators to try to, you know, actually find like common sense ways of updating these frameworks.
I think that's exactly right. I think the one interesting, not necessarily holdout, but somewhat of a maverick player here is Elon Musk. And we've kind of joked through the years, like, what's going to happen when Elon and Tesla throw the switch overnight and basically put out a tweet one morning saying, oh, by the way, we've got fully autonomous, you know, systems ready to go, and, you know, go download the latest software in your car and you're ready. Because that would be a major challenge to federal policy or lack of federal policy. And NHTSA has pushed back with other people before saying, like, hey, some of your systems maybe are in defiance of federal motor vehicle safety standards, even though we don't have clear federal motor vehicle safety standards for all these autonomous systems. So I think it's a to be continued moment. we're not sure, but I think you're exactly right that the technical achievements that we had hoped for aren't quite happening at the pace we wanted. It's really complicated to put a driverless car on the road, and the roads, as you pointed out, are very different everywhere, and conditions are different. So I think the technical factors are probably as big as policy here.
Now, I do want to push back somewhat. I think, you know, there's been a couple of people who've talked about what's the hype cycle for various technologies, you know, and I think driverless cars has been basically exactly what you would have expected, where, you know, you hear all of this initial excitement about it, and people are imagining all the ways in which this is going to totally transform cities, and companies maybe get a little bit ahead of themselves in terms of promising, oh yeah, we're going to have driverless car rollout by 2020, 2019. And then that doesn't happen, or you have, you know, an accident like the Uber accident that happened in Tempe, and there's sort of just like this trough of disillusionment, is I think what it's called, where suddenly people are now underestimating what the true effect of the technology will be. And so I think sometimes if you go into policy circles or on Twitter now, you'll see some people making very bold claims like driverless cars will never happen.
Yeah, right.
Technical progress has been slower in the last couple of years than we expected. So that means we should fundamentally change our priors about the deployment path of this technology, which seems, I think,
I completely agree. There's always a lot of, you know, irrational exuberance in the early days of a lot of emerging technology. And then there's the moment of truth where you realize, okay, it's not going to happen as fast. But I think you're right. I mean, the backlash has been a bit silly at times and extreme. And we're going to see over the next couple of years how this plays out. But let's turn our attention to the other breaking news of last week, which is something you've done a lot of work on, which is artificial intelligence policy more generally. And we had a major announcement from the White House pursuant to an executive order that President Trump issued last year, Executive Order 13859, on maintaining American leadership in artificial intelligence, which directed the Office of Management and Budget to begin coordinating with various other executive branch agencies to develop guidance to all the different agencies in the federal government that could potentially regulate artificial intelligence, machine learning, and autonomous systems. So this document, which came out a few days just before the AV guidance came out, basically stipulates a set of 10 principles for guiding the regulators, sort of regulating the regulators and their ability to impose policy or old law on new developments. So this is an important moment. This is an important sort of governance moment for artificial intelligence, which remains a set of technologies that is quite amorphous, ever-changing, hard to define. And so the Trump administration in this document is, which I should notice is out for public comment, and comments are due March 13th, but sketches out a pretty good vision, in my opinion, and I'm going to ask you for your opinion on this, Caleb, of sort of a generally encouraging forbearance from aggressively looking to regulate AI technologies. And it says on page 2 of the guidance, federal agencies must avoid regulatory and non-regulatory actions that needlessly hamper AI innovation and growth. Agencies must avoid a precautionary approach that holds AI systems to such an impossibly high standard that society cannot enjoy their benefits. So that's a pretty good approach. I mean, as someone who wrote a book called Permissionless Innovation, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
But then there's these 10 principles, and the principles themselves are a bit amorphous, talking about public trust in AI, flexibility, benefits and costs, information quality, safety and security, disclosure and transparency, and then a seventh principle of fairness and non-discrimination. And again, it's not specifying exactly what agencies do, but rather it's saying you should take into account all these 10 factors. And then also there's three other things that it recommends in the form of sort of like informal soft law guidance that says you might also want to consider outside of these standards the use of some non-regulatory approaches. And that's important because that's, again, an acknowledgement by the administration that even though they're not necessarily always on board the idea of soft law and guidances, here they're saying it's okay because technology moves so fast. And they say you, as the agency regulating AI or doing non-policy, non-regulatory policy, can consider sector-specific policy guidances or frameworks, pilot programs and experiments, or voluntary consensus standards. So, again, this is a pretty big moment. Give us some high-level thoughts on how this fits into the broader policy fights over AI, which seem to be intensifying today.
Yeah. So this is, I think, very much in continuation with the executive order that you saw last year. And high level, I think it's pretty good. I think it's hard to find a lot to disagree with in terms of the framework. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, they very much want to make sure we're not unduly delaying the use of some of these new exciting technologies. As is close and near dear to my heart, they put a heavy emphasis on reducing entry barriers to AI. I had a whole paper on that. So I'm glad to see that they're emphasizing a lot of, I think, very important regulatory principles. And I certainly hope that a lot of the agencies take to heart, you know, some of the trade-offs that they're talking about. You know, the fact that we always need to be comparing this to the real world, not to some idealized, you know, imagined perfect world whenever we're thinking about the trade-offs between human versus machine decision making. And yeah, as you mentioned, the focus on, you know, non-regulatory mechanisms of governance as well, I think is well noted. I think if I have a criticism, it's mostly that this is very great rhetoric, but that we need to make sure it's actually enforced, and that I don't know if there are enforcement teeth to do that. It's very easy to say, hey, regulatory agencies, these are great things to consider. And I agree that they're great things to consider. But how do you make sure that this doesn't just become another, you know, paperweight on their desk, another thing telling them to consider these factors, but then they go and do the things that they want to do anyways? Mm-hmm. After the regulatory, or actually after the executive order came out last year, I wrote a piece for Lawfare saying, this is great, but it needs teeth for enforcement. You know, you need, if you want agencies to actually be prioritizing, you know, open government data in the way that the executive order asked them to, you need to give them like staffers to actually do that. They need to be able to have the technical in-house expertise to do the kinds of things that you're asking them to do. And then you need follow-up from Congress to actually like grill them and make sure they're doing the things that you're telling them to do. And I guess I'm afraid that without those kinds of, you know, nitty-gritty implementation details, it's going to end up being very nice rhetoric, a great framework that isn't super followed.
Well, but another perspective to play devil's advocate here would say, yeah, we need more teeth. We need more teeth in the form of like more regulation, right? If anything, this could constrain agencies too much, some critics might say. And in fact, the response I saw from some in the press was very much of that variety. And in fact, they said, well, it's very nice that you're throwing out principles like, you know, risk assessment and flexibility and benefits and costs, but really you need to be doing something about AI fairness and algorithmic discrimination.
Yeah.
You know, bias in AI and machine learning. This is a problem here and now. And this is something you've written about extensively and discussed in various contexts. And, you know, what's our response to that? Because I'll just throw my own opinion out there. I think it's good that they've flagged that this is a concern. And I get that many critics of AI want to make this a reason we would impose a precautionary principle-oriented regulatory regime on AI in the form of a federal robotics commission or a federal algorithmic commission. People have said we need an FDA for algorithms and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, for the same reasons that the memorandum that was issued last week specifies, we don't want to have a sort of preemptive precautionary approach that stifles all the potential unforeseen benefits that come about. So how do we make this balance? Because I think the leading criticism of this from the more activist community, regulatory activist community, is going to be like, we need teeth, but we need teeth to start imposing rules right now, especially for fairness and discrimination.
Yeah. I'd have a couple of replies that I think to that. The first is that this order pretty explicitly says that they're not trying to govern the use of government use of the technology, which I think if you're actually listening closely to critics, maybe they don't even fully realize it, but the vast majority of their concerns and criticisms are government use of the technology. You know, how are local police departments using facial recognition software? How are criminal justice departments, you know, utilizing risk assessment algorithms? That's all, I guess, I would consider that to be a very separate bucket of concerns, and this guidance is pretty explicitly not trying to deal with those. And arguably, we do need stronger action to actually constrain that. You know, you hear pretty wild stories about local police departments, you know, that are using some of these facial recognition systems. They'll hear from a witness, you know, I thought the suspect looked kind of like, you know, some famous celebrity, and then they'll feed in a picture of that famous celebrity into the facial recognition software and start looking for suspects. And that seems very problematic. But that's very different because, one, the government action, you don't have a right of exit to those services. You know, if I think Google's service is biased in some way, I always have options to use other private providers, but I can't choose which police force I want to be governed by or which criminal justice system I want to be tried in based on how good I think their algorithms are. And two, the government typically has a much higher degree of harm they can cause when they do something incorrectly. If your Tinder date, you know, incorrectly matches you with someone, you bum date, you know, but if your life and liberty is being deprived, that's much more problematic. So I think that there's actually useful collaboration that could happen there in terms of how do we effectively govern the use of government use of AI. But it's important to notice that this AI governance has nothing to do with that. You know, it's completely sidestepping.
The document from last week is focused primarily on regulators regulating private sector uses of AI. So let's just be a little bit more clear for our listeners what this guidance would cover. So it would cover something like the FDA imposing new guidelines for an AI-related health or medical app. It would cover the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, what they do for drones. It could cover NHTSA, which we talked about a minute ago with driverless cars. Theoretically, it covers a really broad brush of territory. And one reason I like this memorandum is that it sets forward some principles in a general way because it kind of has to because we just don't know all the AI applications out there. The other thing I like that's unwritten here is that you have to look at this memorandum and the executive order that came before it as part of a richer mosaic of other executive orders and other types of OMB and OIRA guidances to regulators. And so the Trump administration has actually been trying to rein in regulators to some extent and their use of guidances, which is, of course, there's a great irony here because here's a document that is recommending the potential use of certain soft law elements, including guidances. And then with the other hand, the Trump administration is saying, be careful about your use of guidances. And yet I totally respect and understand that tension and that balance they're trying to strike because these informal governance approaches kind of make sense when you're dealing with ever-changing territory beneath your feet and the fast pace of technological change. But you have to keep in mind and also remind the agencies like, you know, hey, you've got to be careful. Yep. There's got to be constraints. We don't want runaway, unaccountable government that's arbitrary and capricious in character.
Yeah, I think there, as you point out, there's a number of tensions in here. One is, I think it correctly notes, you can't have any one single framework that governs all of AI because AI is so broad and amorphous. You know, we want very different frameworks for the use of medical tech versus transportation AI versus, you know, consumer internet applications of AI. Like, those are all very different, have very different kinds of incentives or different kinds of things that could go wrong if they do go wrong. And so it's appropriate that they be governed very differently. Trying to have one department of AI, I think, would be very foolish to try to govern all of those very disparate things. I think a secondary tension here is sort of there's a perceived lack of state capacity, which is what is the ability of the government to do the things it says it wants to do. And so I think a good example of this has been recent proposals for government open data, right? There have been numerous executive orders that came out of the Obama administration and now out of the Trump administration. There have been numerous pieces of federal legislation that have tried to get federal agencies to be putting out more of their data, both for transparency purposes and also because the federal government has lots of useful commercial data that could be used for commercial purposes, right? And there obviously have been some steps forward taken there, but it's still largely ineffective, right? Unless you have a contact at, you know, the Department of Labor or whatever kind of data set you're trying to get, it's really difficult to know, like, how is it coded? Is it in a machine-readable format? You know, is it actually up to date? What do these things mean? You know, sometimes they're not putting out the right kinds of data. And so just I think there's sort of been broad disillusionment with the fact that we keep on trying to do these executive agency or executive orders and legislative proposals that then in practice don't seem to actually have their intended effect. And I think that can then get, you know, maybe critics of technology to be worried that, oh, well, this is just, if we can't, you know, have successful government in this area, this means that obviously our governance frameworks are broken. We need a new agency or, you know, some new something. Let's get around the morass, which is, I think, sort of the flip side of this is saying, you know, we're concerned that you're not actually weighing the appropriate trade-offs, all these executive agencies. So let's just give you some more principles to think about. And it's maybe best as like a second order, you know, without dramatically reshaping how our regulatory agencies currently work. It might be the best we can do. But I think those are playing into the same tension.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think what we see in the memorandum, I think there's some really good principles, but there's also an element that kind of you're getting at, which is a little bit of passing of the buck to the agencies. And this is what Congress does all the time, too, on emerging tech policy yep. making, right? They huff and puff and talk a big game at hearings and in statements about how much they are concerned with, you know, privacy, safety, and security of various emerging technologies. And then they don't really do much about it. And they don't even really exercise their constitutional authority to provide sort of oversight to the administrative agencies and others that are regulating these things. And then now we have the administration saying, well, you know, like we're setting some high-level principles, but you figure it out. But just in this context, you know, pay attention to these values and please don't do anything too crazy, basically, if you read between the lines of what it's saying. And then it's still kicking the can over to the agencies to figure out, like, you just figure it out as you go along. And this is basically what's happened at DOT with driverless cars and FAA at drones, at FDA for, like, various types of AI-related medical apps. And the question is it working? And the old me would have said, like, this is a horrible way to run a government and to govern emerging technology. And indeed, there's a lot of really constitutionally concerning facts about how we're governing emerging technology using soft law. At the same time, the other side of me says, but innovation keeps moving, and we're still getting a lot of things done. And frankly, if we had one big overarching set of principles or laws, I'm not sure they'd be the ones we want. They might be very heavy-handed and precautionary in character, right? So, I mean, I'm very torn about this, and I've said that in my law review articles and my essays about soft law and emerging tech governance more generally. But just as we're getting ready to wrap up here, Caleb, I mean, general thoughts like going forward about how you see emerging tech governance playing out for autonomous systems and AV more generally, or AI more generally, and if there's anything more or better we could be doing on this front.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have lots of proposals for, you know, things that we could be doing better. But I think sort of at a very broad level, so long as we keep with this soft law approach, we're mostly going to be getting sort of what the agencies want to do, which then means that who's running the agencies becomes, you know, disproportionately more important. You know, if Congress were actually following up with agencies and making sure that actually they're doing the kinds of things Congress wants them to be doing, then it would matter less who's heading them, because it's more about like, what is Congress telling you to do? But in sort of light of this broad congressional abdication of power and on the executive level saying, hey, here are things to think about, but we're not going to follow up really too much, then yeah, who's kind of running the agencies might matter a lot. But I think that's also, I think you're right that soft law is growing importance. It might be the best we can do right now. And it's going to become especially important as things move and shift away from even a national level to an international level. Pretty explicitly, you know, OSTP and the people involved in creating this document said that they wanted to push back on some of the international frameworks they saw in AI as being harmful. You know, they think that the EU is overregulating AI. I'm very tempted to agree. I think that's broadly correct. And we don't have good systems of international governance, but as we have things on the one hand, you know, we have global innovation arbitrage where innovation is moving around to the jurisdiction where it's most, you know, accepted. And on the other hand, we have this force that I've sometimes called a regulatory heckler's veto, where, you know, whichever jurisdiction has a large enough market and sets the highest standard, everyone now has to meet that. I think the best example is the GDPR, which Europe has now basically set what are the standards for international institutions that are doing any sort of consumer electronics. You know, they now have to meet the privacy standards of GDPR to actually serve that global market. So international governance is going to be very important for how AI develops over the long run. But because we don't have good international like governance institutions, soft law is de facto what's going to be, you know, what's going to be happening. It's going to be EU regulators and US regulators and Chinese regulators kind of coming together in a room, trying to decide if there are broadly agreed upon frameworks or not. And I think that'll shape a lot of how international law changes with that.
I think that's right. Well, that's about all we have time for in today's show. But before we close, I'm going to ask Caleb to tell us where to follow him on social media. And second, to recommend maybe an essay or paper that he's penned recently that people should read for more information.
Sure. So you can follow me. I'm probably most active on Twitter. I'm just at Caleb Watney. And then I guess most directly related to these sorts of topics, I wrote a paper last year on reducing entry barriers in AI development that I think suggests some very practical next steps that we can do to sort of help further along the AI ecosystem.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter as well at Adam Thier. And I'm also on LinkedIn. You can find me easily there. But you might want to also read the piece I mentioned at the start of the show that I just released last week on Medium, entitled Trump's AI Framework and the Future of Emerging Tech Governance. I also wrote a very long law review article that's quite boring but very detailed about soft law for hard problems, and it documents future trends in the field of emerging technology governance. I co-authored that with Ryan Hageman and Jennifer Huddleston for the Colorado Technology Law Journal. So that's it. Thanks for joining us on today's show. I want to ask our audience to make sure to subscribe to the Fourth Branch podcast on whatever podcasting platform that they enjoy using, and to comment on today's show and let us know what you thought. I'm Adam Thier. See you next time.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.